From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Dr. Brian Weiss joins us as we explore past lives. If you get up to the coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at the feature article that we have posted. Listen to this one. A small piece of cloth bearing a very eerie detailed image of a bearded man with a bruised face is to be the subject of a papal pilgrimage next week. Pope Benedict XVI will journey to a remote monastery east of Rome next Friday to visit this very mysterious cloth, said to show the face of Christ. Known by locals as Veronica's Veil, the cloth, measuring 9.5 inches by 6.5 inches, is said to have been used by Saint Veronica to wipe Jesus' brow on his walk to the cross. It later assumed Jesus' image, apparently, showing a man, eyes open, with a beard and a mustache. The history of the icon is sketchy. Nothing is known of its whereabouts after Christ's crucifixion, but it is said to have been taken to Rome in 1297. Locals in a very remote town of a mountain region said the icon was brought to them 500 years ago by a wandering pilgrim. It now resides in the town's monastery, where it is stretched between two panes of glass in a golden frame. The image clearly shows the face of a Christ-like figure when held up against daylight. However, the image on the veil disappears. In recent months, Veronica's Veil has been the subject of an influx of tourists from Rome, keen to see what they view as a holy relic. The Vatican has stressed, however, that the Pope's visit does not mean that he is officially endorsing the veil. In 1999, scientists from a university in southern Italy reported that the image had not been painted or embossed on the veil in any way that could be explained. It's a great story. In just a few years after the last solar cycle ended, there is now evidence that the next one, which is expected to be the biggest in 50 years, may have already begun. Sunspots, flares, and coronal mass ejections disrupt radio and telecommunications, including cell phones, and if they become strong enough, they can be especially dangerous for astronauts. They can also have effects on the weather, if very powerful enough. Large sunspots, which reduce the amount of solar heat reaching the Earth, can cause cooling, while the coronal mass ejections may have the opposite effect, so get ready for some very strange and unusual weather because of this. A board of Russian medics has deemed a Japanese businessman who has been preparing to travel to the International Space Station as a tourist on board of a Russian crew craft, he's unfit to fly. They say he can't go into space. The Virginia-based firm called Space Adventures, which brokered his flight with Russia's Federal Space Agency, confirmed the medical issue in a statement. The Japanese man was to become the fourth space tourist had he flown aboard the Soyuz that would take him up there. A swarm of killer bees attacked a man and his father as they repaired a roof in a small town in southeast Arizona, killing one man, hospitalizing the other. Cochise County Sheriff's deputies say that the Africanized honeybees stung the 39-year-old Charlie Pasley more than 300 times as he carried out repairs in a home southeast of Phoenix. He died at the scene. Spokeswoman says that his father, Charles, 62, is reported in stable condition in the hospital. The insects, commonly known as killer bees for their very highly aggressive behavior, are descended from a ferocious strain that was first introduced to the Americas from Africa in the 1950s in the hope that they would produce more honey. Well, it all fell apart. The bees absconded from research hives in Brazil, slowly spreading through South and Central America. They first crossed into Texas from Mexico in 1990. Since then, they have attacked and killed dozens of people. In Los Angeles, John Mark Carr was sitting in a high-security jail cell awaiting extradition to Colorado, where he faces charges in the 1996 killing of 6-year-old JonBenet Ramsey. Carr was arrested at L.A. International Airport on a warrant from Boulder, Colorado, after getting off a Thai Airways flight where he feasted on champagne toasts and roast duck. Boulder authorities said that Carr was expected to have an extradition hearing in Los Angeles within days. We believe it is scheduled for tomorrow morning in Los Angeles. While in Thailand, Carr, by the way, had visited a clinic to have facial hair removed permanently because he wanted to prepare for a sex change operation. The story just gets stranger and stranger. Mystic Uri Geller is suing the former owners of Elvis Presley's first home, claiming breach of contract. Geller thought that he had won the Tennessee house after he bid $905,100 for the house on eBay, but the owner sold the property to a Nashville record producer for reportedly $1 million. So Uri is in court suing, trying to make sure that he can get the house back from the sellers. In London, police found martyrdom videos and bomb-making components during the investigation of the alleged plot to blow up U.S.-bound jetliners, according to prosecutors, in announcing that 11 people there had been charged with terrorism offenses. The officials confirmed for the first time that the plot involved the manufacture of explosives, which were to be used to assemble and detonate bombs inside as many as 10 airliners. The U.S. officials previously had said that the plot appeared to involve mixing liquid-based chemicals to make explosives aboard the aircrafts. One person was released from custody. Police continue to interrogate 11 others who remain under active investigation. A defiant Saddam Hussein shouted at prosecutors in Baghdad and refused to enter a plea at the opening of his second trial. We won't know until October 16 about his first trial, where he'll probably face execution if found guilty. But this is his second trial, where he faces charges of genocide and war crimes connected to his scorched earth offensives against Kurds nearly two decades ago. Opposition among Americans, by the way, to the war in Iraq has reached a new high, according to a CNN poll where they say 61% of the Americans polled oppose the war. Iran's Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei said his country will press ahead with its nuclear program. He was speaking a day before Tehran is scheduled to give its formal answer to an international proposal of incentives for Iran to stop uranium enrichment. As a matter of fact, they're already turning down UN inspectors. They won't let anybody in to any of these atomic plants, so I don't know what's going to happen there. However, the mutually assured destruction just won't work anymore, according to one Middle East expert whose forecast that night of August 22nd says it may prove to be a calamity. It's fueling worry around the world. Bernard Lewis of Princeton has had the opinion pieces circulating for a couple weeks now that this is going to be a very strange day all around the planet. Well, in a moment, we'll be talking with Robert Spencer of Jihad Watch. We're going to get his take on this August 22nd date in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Robert Spencer is the director of Jihad Watch. He is a writer, researcher, and has written several books as well as over 100 articles about jihad and Islamic terrorism. His latest book is the New York Times bestseller, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades. He's also got a forthcoming book called The Truth About. Spencer's been studying Islamic theology, law, and history in depth since 1980. He's our guest this hour on Coast to Coast. Robert, thanks for joining us. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Good. This date, this ominous date that people keep talking about, August 22nd, it is now that date in the Middle East. What is, Robert, supposed to happen?
Well, nobody really knows for sure, but the date is important because, in the first place, it's the date that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, set for answering the offer from the West for various incentives to give up his nuclear program. And this was curious in the beginning because the offer was made in June. And they wanted him to answer by the end of June, and he said, no, I will give you your answer on August 22nd. And nobody really could understand why a relatively simple offer like this would take him 2 months to evaluate. But August 22nd corresponds this year to Rajab 27th on the Islamic calendar. And Rajab 27th is the date on which Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, is, according to Islamic legend, supposed to have traveled miraculously from Mecca to Jerusalem and from Jerusalem to paradise, with Allah illuminating the night sky over Jerusalem to make the journey possible. And so Fareed Ghadri of the Reform Party of Syria postulated in July, and I wrote an article about this at this time, and then a couple weeks later, Bernard Lewis picked it up and some other people, that the idea that Ahmadinejad might have for August 22nd would be to illuminate the night sky over Jerusalem, that is, with a nuclear device. There are other things he may have in mind. We'll certainly find out soon enough. But I think that this is a serious enough possibility that I hope authorities are monitoring the situation in Iran today very closely.
Well, I'm convinced, Robert, that Iran has been just buying time with its nuclear program. I mean, yeah. Every time a deadline comes up, they seem to push it back, or the UN just doesn't force the issue. I think they're getting very close to getting the bomb.
I think you're right.
In Iran at this point, are they strong enough to take on other nations in a full-fledged war, or are they suicidal? Do they just simply not care?
You know, that's the key point here. That's an excellent question. Most people assume, well, wait a minute, there's no way that they're strong enough, and so why would they do this? And they assume that this mutually assured destruction model that you mentioned earlier is what's operative here, as it has been in every other conflict that anybody can remember. But the fact is that in the Shiite Muslim belief, the Imam Mahdi, the savior figure, the 12th Imam, the hidden Imam, who's been hiding for since the 9th century and is going to reappear at the end of the world, he's only going to reappear after a period of great persecution and calamity for the Muslims. And so it is entirely within the realm of possibility that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is perfectly willing to bring terrible destruction even upon his own nation in order to hasten that time of persecution and calamity, to make that calamity sufficient for the return of the Mahdi.
So these people are not humanitarians, and I'm talking about the fanatics now. They simply are so fanatical about their own religion, they're prepared to destroy or put us all on the brink of a world war, another one, just because of this ideology?
Yes, no doubt about that, and the ideology is rooted in a love of death, which makes mutually assured destruction completely useless, because obviously if you don't fear being destroyed, then you cannot be deterred by the threat of destruction. And so the problem is that we've seen this for years now with the Sunni Muslim jihad terrorists, and we see it now with the Shiites. It was summed up, I think, very well by Maulana Inayatullah, who was a Sunni jihadist in Afghanistan, quoted a few years ago saying, "The Americans love Pepsi Cola, we love death." And there you are. You can't deter that.
Robert, it is morning in the Middle East now, so we would be talking about sometime later on our time here in the United States if there's going to be any big event. Now, what happens if the day comes and goes and just nothing happens?
I wouldn't be in the least surprised, because we have seen nothing more common coming out of people like Ahmadinejad and others in the Middle East than empty threats. Saber rattling and attempts to arouse terror in the populations they consider the enemy simply by threats. And Osama bin Laden, right after 9/11, you may recall, he said many more airplanes are going to be falling out of the skies. Well, they didn't. And I remember in November 2003, there was a lot of excitement, a lot of chatter in the Islamic websites. A lot of people thought that there was going to be a major attack. Nothing happened. There was another time when Muslims were actually warned by the jihad terrorists to get out of Los Angeles and Washington and New York. Nothing happened. And so it's possible, it's entirely within the realm of possibility, if not probability, that nothing will happen. But it still, we can't afford simply to dismiss it out of hand, because after all, we also know that some of the threats that these groups have made are not at all empty.
All right, so some of this could be rhetoric, but what you're saying is we need as a nation, we need as a world to listen to what they're saying very closely.
That's exactly it. And I hope that the relevant authorities are monitoring troop movements in Iran, various other movements in Iran today in particular.
Apparently, I've gotten several emails from some people talking about some kind of military exercises in Iran.
That's right. They're going on this week.
Now, isn't that strange?
That and also the fact that the UN inspectors were turned away yesterday and not allowed to inspect the installations in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
If Iran were to begin war, let's say with just Israel, mm-hmm. you know, the lights over Jerusalem, per se, mm-hmm. They have the capability, they have the distance in some of their missiles to fire, and I'm talking about weaponry far more superior than what they've been giving the Hezbollah.
Yes. And, well, this is entirely within the realm of possibility. I mean, I think we need to take seriously what he has said, Ahmadinejad, and he's made it very clear that he doesn't believe Israel is legitimate, he doesn't believe it has a right to exist, and he'd like to do nothing better than to wipe it out. And he's also said that its destruction is imminent, it's coming soon.
Do you think Israel, and let's just rule out its nuclear capability for just a moment, do you think it has the capability of beating Iran in a conventional war?
I might have said so before this adventure with Hezbollah, but now I'm not sure that I would. At this point, I think it's more a matter of will than a matter of ability. But the will is something that doesn't seem to be entirely there anymore.
So what are the possibilities if Iran provokes Israel to a point? I do not believe, personally, that the Israelis would ever use its nuclear arsenal. But when faced with the possibility of total destruction, what choice do they have? What will happen?
Yeah, well, exactly. And I think that they're thinking along exactly the same lines. The president, of course, has promised that the United States would defend Israel in that eventuality. And so you're talking about also the widening of the conflict.
I got to tell you, though, I am so disappointed, Robert, with the United Nations, even with the way they've handled this situation. It's almost as if the United States, France, Russia, somewhat, had to get involved, even without the United Nations saying anything.
Yes. Well, absolutely. Because the United Nations, well, you know, the biggest voting bloc in the United Nations since the collapse of communism is the Organization of the Islamic Conference. And so, really, the United Nations has become impotent to do anything effective against jihad terrorism because those countries, above all, don't want to alienate the people who are sympathetic to the jihadists.
Tell me about Jihad Watch. What is your organization?
Jihad Watch is dedicated to make the increasing awareness of the ideology that fuels the jihad terrorism around the world, showing that these are not discrete, separate, unrelated nationalistic conflicts, but that they do spring from a single ideological center. They have all come from this common ideology. The jihadists around the world share this ideology. So we report on the news every day at jihadwatch.org, the jihad news. We collect it all together, and we include commentary and explanation to make clear how these things relate to one another.
Oh, and I wanted you to point out, too, Robert, you do not dislike people who practice the Islamic faith.
Of course. I mean, of course, you know, the idea that to tell the truth about the roots of Islamic terrorism means that you dislike Muslims, this is ridiculous. And this is really just a tactic that the jihadists and their sympathizers and American Muslim advocacy groups use to silence people who speak honestly about what needs to be reformed within Islam, what needs to be acknowledged in Islam and rejected by Muslims who want to live in peace with the rest of the world. They use the idea that such people who speak about these things hate Muslims to discredit them in the eyes of people of goodwill. It's just a rhetorical tactic. But obviously, that if Islam teaches certain things, and if certain of those things are acted upon by Muslims, and I report on them, that doesn't mean I hate anybody. That's simply a matter of fact, and it can be verified by looking at the sources that I'm using.
Did you happen to see Mike Wallace's chat with the Iranian president, and did you
Yes.
see anything that came out of that interview which would lead you to believe that something could happen on Tuesday morning or
something
Tuesday night?
Something very definite I saw in that interview, actually, and that was that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was acting, and here is an illustration of what I was just saying, that the jihadists use traditional Islam. they work according to the categories of traditional Islam. Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, taught that unbelievers must be offered three choices. Conversion to Islam first. They are approached by the Muslims and invited to convert. If they accept, then there's no war. If they refuse, they are invited to enter the Islamic social order, which would institutionalize and enforce upon them second-class status. They would not enjoy equality of rights with Muslims. If they refuse that, then they must be fought. So it's conversion, subjugation, or war. Now look closely at what Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said to Mike Wallace. He said, look, I wrote to President Bush, and I invited him to accept Islam. Now the president has free will, but I want you to tell him, Ahmadinejad said to Mike Wallace, tell him that you have free will, but with a choice that is rejected, there are consequences. And so he's saying, you rejected my call to accept Islam. Now we're going to go to war with you.
Interesting. Stay with us, Robert. We're keeping you for some phone calls for the next 25 minutes. So we'll open up the phone lines with our guest tonight, Robert Spencer, this hour, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, at the top of the hour, Dr. Brian Weiss joins us. We're going to talk about past lives, same soul, many bodies. I'm looking forward to that. We're going to take phone calls for the rest of this hour with our special guest, Robert Spencer. So we talk about this ominous August 22nd date. And let's knock on wood and say a little prayer that nothing of any major consequence happens. And by the way, many of you have emailed me wanting pictures of Georgie the dog, my dog in St. Louis. And you can see Georgie's picture under the Digicam banner that we've got there right under the feature article at coasttocoastam.com. Robert, are we being the boy who cried wolf? You know, are we being the ones to just shout and shout and shout and then nothing happens? Are we being used by these fanatics?
No, I don't think so. Things do happen. 9/11 happened. July 7th in London happened. March 2004 happened. We have to take seriously what's being said there by Ahmadinejad and others. That doesn't mean that everything is going to be exactly as they say, because they do traffic in a lot of lies and deceptions. But we're making that perfectly clear. I would be not in the least surprised, as I said before, if nothing happens today.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up by going west of the Rockies, first of all. You're on Coast to Coast. Hello there.
Good evening, George. Thanks for taking my call. Good to speak with you and your guest tonight.
Thank you.
And I wanted to ask him, it seems to me that Israel, of all the global nations, would have the most entrenched interest in defeating and preventing this prospective attack from Ahmadinejad in Iran. And I have to believe that the Mossad is at least as well informed as any global agency would be. And so is there a reasonable chance that despite the entrenchment in which Israel has found itself recently, that they may just muster the courage, as it were, to the initiative to sort of nip this thing in the bud? And might we see a pronounced effort by Israel to head off the threat from Iran?
Yeah, I think that's a very distinct possibility. As a matter of fact, just now, over the news flashes from Haaretz, the newspaper in Israel, we learned that Israelis are being told to prepare bomb shelters for a possible confrontation with Iran. And that may be a signal that they do have the will, they are not going to let this happen, and they're going to take preventative measures.
Well, that's encouraging, and especially considering the conflagration in which we've seen them involved in the last couple weeks or the last month or so, and a lot of commentators have been crying despair as though this has really brought Israel to its knees, and it does seem that Iran might see fit to take advantage of that, and I hope that Israel can indeed set this to rest, if at all possible.
Yeah, I hope so. The game isn't over. Israel has suffered a setback, and that setback was aided and abetted by the United States in not realizing the implications of enforcing a ceasefire that will effectively place Hezbollah as the guards at the border. of Israel and Lebanon. And so there's no doubt. I mean, we can't sugarcoat that, but that doesn't mean that Israel is destroyed and the whole thing is done. And there is a growing a sense in Israel, as well as elsewhere, that we have to be strong in the face of a very, very large threat, maybe a threat larger than most of us have even wanted to admit could possibly be real. But I don't think it's too late for people in Israel and elsewhere who value the civilization that has come, that we have built, that we are the heirs to, that it's not too late for us to summon our resources and to stand against this. The law that the Islamic terrorists would like to enforce upon the rest of us denies equality of rights to women and to non-Muslims, and we have to stand resolutely against that and say our way of life is better and we're going to defend it.
Robert, some sources in Israel say that Syria is arming Hezbollah as we speak through the Bekaa Valley, and nobody's doing anything about it. And I'm just wondering when Israel goes back in again.
Well, the one good sign we've seen in the last few weeks is that they have threatened to go back in again, that they have made it clear that they're not going to stand for a sham ceasefire. And so I hope they'll follow through on that.
Let's go to our next East of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, I'm Kevin from Quebec City, Canada.
Yes, Kevin, go ahead.
Okay,
please.
Good morning, everyone. Great guest, by the way.
Thank you.
I have one question and a comment, if I may, to your guest. Do you know about Saeed Qutb?
Yes, I certainly do. In my book, Onward Muslim Soldiers, a few years ago, there's an in-depth profile of him and his writings.
Right, because he is the granddaddy behind the integrism and the fundamentalism of bin Laden and the Sunni brand, right?
Yes, to a great degree, he is. There are some others who are influential, and most notably Syed Abdullah Maududi in Pakistan.
Okay, and bin Baz as well?
I'm sorry?
Bin Baz?
Yes, absolutely, bin Baz
Saudi Arabia. One comment, if I may. I'm studying the Bible and the Quran at the same time, trying to find out where this violent ideology comes from in the Quran. And this, and correct me if I'm mistaken, but my final analysis of it is the defensive jihad that is allowed in the Quran states that there is an enemy at your doorsteps and you have to protect yourself from that enemy, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, in the Bible, there is the sense of good and bad. But the bad is not a person, is not the enemy. In the Quran, you have good and bad plus that darn enemy, which I think opens up the door to all that defensive jihad that all the extremists are talking about, even Muhammad, the British guy with the sheikh, what's his name?
Bakri Muhammad?
Yes, and the guy with no hands there.
Abu Hamza.
Yeah, Abu Hamza. They all talk about defensive jihad, and it's in the Quran for sure. But in the Bible, there is no enemy at your doorstep. It's only good and bad, right?
Well, exactly. In the Bible, the idea is that the dividing line between good and evil is within every person's heart. And so if you can't eradicate the evil in the world by making war against one group or the other. But in the Quran and in Islamic tradition, the division is between believers and unbelievers. And it's a very sharp division that delineates the dividing line between good and evil as between believers and unbelievers. The unbelievers in the Quran, chapter 98, verse 6, are the vilest of creatures. And the Quran not only teaches defensive warfare against them, but also offensive warfare to establish the hegemony of Islamic law. Right now, the jihad terrorists are talking exclusively about defensive warfare because of the legal tradition within Islam that only the caliph, the leader of the unified Muslim community, can call offensive jihad. But defensive jihad becomes the responsibility of every Muslim when a Muslim land is attacked, and that's why they use Iraq and Afghanistan as a rallying point. But ultimately, they want to use the offensive jihad once the caliphate is reestablished to establish Islamic law not only in the Islamic world, where it is not fully enforced today except in Saudi Arabia and Iran, but over the rest of us as well, and will do violence and perform acts of subversion in order to bring this about.
Robert, I was brought up as a Catholic, so I have the knowledge of the order from the Vatican and how it goes all the way down through the Archbishop, the Monsignor role, the priest level.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an order to it in the Catholic Church. I assume there's an order to it if you're a Baptist or an Episcopalian as well.
Yes.
In terms of those who are Muslims practicing the faith of Islam, who appoints the various sheikhs and holy people to their particular area? How does that happen?
There's a ruling religious council, the Council of Islamic Scholars, in every Muslim country. and they exercise probably what's the closest thing to the analogy of the order that you're talking about.
But that is in every country separately, you're saying?
Yes. But there are also schools of jurisprudence. And there, in Sunni Islam, there are four major schools of jurisprudence and a few other smaller ones. But most of the Muslims who are Sunnis, and of course the Sunnis are 85 to 90% of all Muslims worldwide, most of them belong to one or another of these four schools, the Shafi'i, Hanafi, Hanbali, or Maliki. And those have various, very well-defined legal traditions. And the imams of those various schools explicate the Quran and Islamic law according to the rules of those traditions. They all share the teaching that the jihad to establish the hegemony of Islamic law over the world is part of the responsibility of the Muslim community to pursue. That's not something they disagree on, and there's not as it's not as if there's a peaceful school and then the violent
school.
Well,
I was going to say, do any of them say love your fellow man? Do they teach that?
Love your fellow Muslim. But in the Quran, it's very clear. Chapter 48, verse 29 says, Muhammad is the apostle of Allah. Those who follow him are merciful to one another, but ruthless to the unbelievers. And so you can find teachings about being charitable, about being kind, about being gentle and generous and everything else to your fellow Muslim, but not to the unbelievers.
Well, do you have to be a Muslim to be a believer?
Yes.
Hmm. All right, let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to the program. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing, Jordan?
Good.
Hi, this is James from Buffalo, Illinois. I was wanting to ask Mr. Spencer about what he thought about the possibility. They say Iran has something like 20,000 sleeper cells across the world. And I was kind of just curious if he thought that they might be activated as kind of like a big announcement tomorrow, you know, instead of a bomb going off in Israel or an attack on Israel or something to kind of cripple the U.S. And then what his thoughts were, say, that were to happen, if something like maybe China would go after Taiwan or, you know, something while our eye was kind of turned the other way.
That's a good point. Who's got the sleeper cells anyway, Robert? We hear Al-Qaeda. We don't even hear their name hardly anymore.
Yeah.
You know, we heard that Hezbollah has sleeper cells in the United States, and
yes,
now we hear Iran. So what's going on?
Well, to say Hezbollah or Iran has sleeper cells in the United States is really saying the same thing.
It is, okay.
It's essentially the same group. But there are other sleeper cells. They do exist. Obviously, we don't know where they all are or what they're all doing. Whether they'll be activated today or tomorrow is anybody's guess. It's just as good a guess as anybody else has. But they could, if they have as many as they say, and I don't believe they do, but I do believe they have some, and they could cause significant damage. Would another state take advantage of that damage in order to achieve their own ends? Well, I think that's very likely.
Next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Mr. Spencer.
Hi.
My name is Mark. I'm a trucker. I'm calling, listening on XM Radio.
Okay, Mark. Thanks
and
for calling.
I was just wondering on, I heard reports today of Iranians over in North Korea watching some of their exercises or whatever they were doing over there.
Yes, that's right.
And that I was wondering if this Muslim thing that they're talking about on the 22nd, could it be where they would all come together, all the Muslim nations, to try to attack Israel?
Well, it's possible. It's certainly possible. That's one thing they can agree on and unite on at this point. And Mahmoud Ahmadinejad certainly has tried to position himself as the leader of the Muslims in their war against Israel. And so there again, you have another possibility. But you mentioned North Korea. North Korea, of course, is not an Islamic country, but there has been military collaboration on bomb-making material and technology between Iran and North Korea.
Can one assume that Israel annihilated parts of Hezbollah, the groups of Hezbollah, or do you think it was a failed battle here?
Well, it was both. They did annihilate parts of Hezbollah, and parts of Hezbollah are still there. They had to stop too soon because of pressure from the United States, from the United Nations, from the European Union. If they had been allowed to continue and not been hamstrung by these trumped-up media photos and so on that tried to establish that they were killing civilians and so on purpose and that kind of thing, if they had not had to stop, then they would have been able to do significant more damage to Hezbollah. But Hezbollah still is there, still a real threat, a big threat, and we owe it to this ceasefire.
I do not believe that Israel was killing civilians on purpose, but what I do happen to believe was that they knew, let's say, that Hezbollah might have interjected themselves with civilians, and they figured, we still have to take them out. It's unfortunate civilians are going to die. And they made the decision. Yeah, they made the decision based on that.
They do not have Hezbollah military bases. They do not have Hezbollah...
The uniforms.
Yeah, right? Exactly. They work in ordinary clothes in civilian neighborhoods on purpose in order to draw responses they can use as propaganda victories.
East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Good morning.
Good morning. It's Peter from Dearborn Heights.
Hey, Peter. Go ahead.
Yes, I met Hassan Nasrallah about 4 years ago down in Dearborn.
Oh, yeah.
And I spoke to him. I told him about Chapter 11 of Revelations. And this is brother against brother. If you... George had Glenn Kimmel on a few days ago where he told about the Babylonian captivity where all the Jews were taken up to Syria and Babylon by Baghdad. And only 46,000 came back when Cyrus, the king of Persia, was told by Angel Gabriel, who talked to him for 21 days and with the help of Michael. And he put out a decree which had the Israelis come back to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. So it wasn't by might or force. It was by God that the Jews are protected. And the Jews have to come back to God.
And you told this to Hassan Nasrallah?
I told Hassan Nasrallah about the end times.
Ah, well, you know, Hassan Nasrallah, if you told him that the Jews are protected by God, he would say that ended when the Jews rejected Muhammad, and now they're under the curse of God.
Believe it or not, the Jews have the choice of the curse or the blessing, and they've chosen the curse.
Well, that's I suppose there are quite a few people who might disagree with you about that.
And but, I also had a word of
Nasrallah would certainly say, yes, they've chosen the curse. He might not mean the same thing you mean.
I was told by God that if you do not heed my words, I will destroy the temple of God in Jerusalem.
Oh, I see what you're saying, yes. Well, Hassan Nasrallah is considering that they have rejected God by rejecting Muhammad, not by what you're referring to.
My take on this date, Robert, which of course is now the 22nd in the Middle East,
yes.
I think it's going to come and go without any major event.
I sure hope you're right.
However, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't keep a watchful eye out for things.
Yes, definitely.
And that's the whole thing. So what is your take on this overall situation then? I mean, people are beginning to believe that there is a major war brewing here that will involve the United States. Does it look like this is going to be a peaceful way out, or do you think it's going to have to go the other way?
No, I think that the bellicosity, the genocidal bellicosity that's coming out of Iran now makes it clear that there's not going to be a peaceful negotiated settlement here. We're going to have to take out Iran's nuclear installations at one time or another.
And it'll probably be sooner than later.
Yes.
Well, that's what's going to happen. That's probably the way it's going to be. Robert, thanks for being our guest. I appreciate
Thank you.
It. Okay, that's Robert Spencer. He heads up Jihad Watch. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com, but it's jihadwatch.com for those of you who want to go and take a look at some of the things that he has been doing. And like I say, we'll get through this date and we'll see what happens. But I just, I don't know, my gut tells me that it will come and go and it could be pretty uneventful, at least I hope I'm right. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. You can do that just about any time you want. And we've also got a system called Fast Blast, which gives you instant messages to us when we're on the air. You can register for that. There is no cost. You just go to the coasttocoastam.com website. On the left-hand side of the screen, take a look at the eyes of Sigmund Freud. They are not mine. Click around there, and you'll be able to register for Fast Blast, and you send me messages while we're on the air, and quite frankly, some of your questions are very, very good with the guests that we've got on the program. So in just a moment, our guest will be Dr. Brian Weiss. He is a traditional psychotherapist, and get ready for this, because he was astonished and skeptical when one of his patients began recalling past life traumas. I'll tell you why when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.